Well, I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for inviting me and Victor Ivry for supporting me. And this is what? Sorry, I take it back. Right. This is a joint work with Maxim Skryganov from St. Petersburg. Right. As you see, the title of my talk has a distinct number theoretic taste. Of course, I don't have to explain in this audience that to find a relationship between number theoretic lattice counting problems and spectral theory, I don't have to go too far. Right? You want to study Laplace operator. The first thing you do, you study Laplace on the torus, and here you have your lattice counting problem. Actually, the motivation that was the most inspiring for us was the connection of lattice counting problems with the periodic problems on the entire space when you don't have any compact manifold initially. So, for example, this is the motivation part, and I'm just trying to explain and give some draw some pictures that will be useful in the in what follows. Now, if you have this kind of operator, this is the Schrödinger operator, you have a potential, let's say infinitely smooth potential, periodic with respect to a lattice. And this is all happening in RD, and I assume that D is greater than or equal to 2. Then if you want to know the spectral structure, instead of this operator, you look at this one. So this is the natural reduction, which is called the Flaquet theory. I will do it very quickly. I don't want to stay too long on this. Natural reduction, which is called Flaquet theory, you look at this operator with the additional parameter K. So K is the real value for, this is a vector from RD, which is called quasi-momentum, by the way. And this operator is studied on the torus, which is just the RD factor gamma. And then what you have now, you have discrete eigenvalues for this operator instead of the continuous spectrum of the initial operator. And you can study now how these eigenvalues change when this parameter changes, parameter K changes. Right? K varies, and you have something like this. This is the very, very much simplified picture. One-dimensional one. In multidimensional case, you can have a richer structure. So you have branches of eigenvalues. This is one, and then this, then you might have something, I don't know, something like that, or you have something even more outrageous. And here, probably I should take it further down to make it more spectacular. Now, what you have here, you have the overlap of spectral branches. So these are, this is the set of values of eigenvalue lambda 2, and this is the set of values of eigenvalue lambda 1. Right, so you have overlap of these two branches. Sorry?
More than one dimension.
Of course. Yes, one dimension, it is impossible. So I'm drawing a picture which is forcibly one-dimensional, but it has a multidimensional effect built in. Right. So then you have an overlap of these two intervals, which means that the spectral bands in the spectrum of the periodic operator will also overlap. Okay, so this is the picture that inspired us. And we wanted to start, of course, and it's a natural thing to do, if you want to study the spectrum of this, you start with the unperturbed thing. So you look at this operator, and you look at the spectral branches of this thing, all which is the same. You count integers, or you count lattice point in certain lattice. So let's do that. So again, lattice is, so to fix the notation, lattice is in this space, which is dimension of which is greater than or equal to 2. Then I will denote by this. This is n of c in square brackets. This is the number of points of the lattice. Well, actually, like that, probably better. Number of points in the set C, this is a bounded set. Bounded. Okay. In a bounded set C. And the most interesting for me will be counting integers, counting lattice points in balls of radius R. So this will be the notation. This is the standard notation. This is the radius. This is the center. This is the number. Oh, sorry. This is the set of all this is a ball essentially. That's all. Centered at the point K. This is the open ball. Okay. So R is positive or non-negative, and K is again real a vector in RD. Okay. So this will be the most interesting thing. And I will sometimes I will denote this just to make the notation shorter. I will denote it like that. It will be just RK. Another set that I will need, and I will, this is absolutely imperative that I have this set. This is the sphere. So this is the set of all points, sphere centered at the point K. Okay. All right. Now the object that I'm going to look at is this. This is what we're going to study, and I will call it delta variation. Delta variation for the lattice counting. It will be the following quantity. I will take lambda delta. This is the notation for this delta variation. So it depends on the point lambda and on the parameter delta. And this is the... Okay. I will write it first, and then I will have to make a step back to explain what is written here. So this is n plus. It will be the maximal number of maximum of that function in K. I will write this down in a second. Here n plus and then minus are respectively maximal and minimal value of this function. Okay. So in here I'm not using just R. I don't use just notation R for radius. This is the square root of some quantity, lambda minus delta, lambda plus delta. This is the most convenient thing because of that spectral interpretation. Suppose that delta is zero. Then what we measure here is the difference between maximal number of spectral branches below given level lambda. This is level lambda. This is the maximal level, maximal number of spectral branches below lambda minus minimal number of spectral branches. And this quantity tells you how many of those branches cross this point lambda. Now, if we look at this quantity, lambda, with delta non-trivial, with delta positive, then it gives us more information. It tells us that if you take now the interval lambda plus delta, I probably need another chew. If you take an interval lambda plus delta and lambda minus delta here, if this quantity is positive, it tells you that there are this many spectral branches that contain the interval lambda minus delta, lambda plus delta. Okay? And this is what we wanted to get. This is what we wanted to study because we wanted to know that this periodic operator, every band of the spectrum contains an interval of fixed length. This is what we wanted to do. Okay? This is why we studied this quantity. Notice that we subtract something which is, well, intuitively or naively smaller. This is something which is bigger than that, naively, because it has lambda plus delta. But when we minimize it in K, we really make it smaller than that. So there is a subtle interplay. Say it. Say again? Thank you for the question. In the main result, delta will be independent. It will be uniform for all lambda, meaning that however far you go up this axis, you will have the same interval always in the spectrum. In certain cases, you will have to choose it dependent on lambda. I will discuss that in a second. Okay. So, right, let's talk about known results. Let's try, first of all, to find out what will happen if we just apply our naive understanding of how the counting function of lattice points behaves. So let's write that. We'll just write a very simple formula. You're going to take the asymptotic formula for n plus minus. It will be obviously something of this sort. This is the main term. I'm just writing the usual formula. I replace the main term by the volume of the ball plus a remainder. The volume, well, it's not exactly the volume of the ball. I have to divide by the domain, by the volume of the fundamental domain, of course. But we can assume for convenience that this is 1. Now, and this is going to be a remainder estimate here. It depends on plus or minus, of course. And, well, as you can see, the question, what is this remainder, is a very well-known and famous question. You can ask it in 2 dimensions, in 3 dimensions, and in higher dimensions, it will have different answer. It was discussed in Yanis Petutis' lecture the day before yesterday, for example. Now, naively, what can we do? Let's write this down using this representation. When we ignore the terms of order 2 in delta, when we substitute those things in this formula, then we will get this. We will get something which depends. I'm not sure that I'm writing. I'm getting the constants right, but it doesn't really matter. This is delta, and here I will have d minus 2, right? If I take n plus, subtract n minus, and then I will have r plus lambda plus delta, or lambda minus delta, excuse me, minus r minus lambda plus delta. Right. So it's clear that we need to study this remainder to make sure that this quantity is positive. This quantity is positive. We need to make sure that this difference dominates. It kills what we get here. Yeah, there is a relation, and a very simple one. Thank you. All right. Now, what can we say about this remainder R? And this is proposition 1. This is a known result. This is not the main result of this talk. Let d be, as we assumed, greater than or equal to 2, then r plus is greater than r with the constant d minus 1 over 2, right? This is the usual power that we get in these situations. And then I will multiply it by some function phi that I will specify in a second. I wish I could put 1 in here, but I cannot. So this is r minus is less than minus c r d minus 1 phi over r. Square root lambda minus delta, when you take lambda out, you have d here, right? So you get d minus. Do you want me to? Okay. No. You mean constant c? Well, all these constants, they will be different from line to line. I don't actually want to keep track of the values of the constants. Sometimes, oh, you mean these two constants? Yes, they are the same. And they're both positive, and they're equal to each other. So C will denote... Yes, phi r, I haven't specified that. I was asked a different question. Now, phi r is, well, this is an interesting story, I must tell you. This is one if dimension is not 1 modulo 4, right? So if it is not 5, 9, 13, and so on, then this is 1. And if it is not the case, meaning that we have dimensions of these exceptional values, then this is exponential minus yet another constant. And then we have double log of r to power 4. Okay? Well, this is a known result. This has been known for a while. First, probably in 82, that was Dalberg and Trubowitz. Dalberg-Trubowitz for this result. And then 97, Elfer Mohamed. They used the same method. This was proved for two dimensions, Dalberg-Trubowitz, and then Elfer Mohamed proved it for arbitrary dimensions avoiding these. Okay, this is a very simple technical trick. Unfortunately, I don't have time to discuss that. But this result was proved in 2001 by Konyagin, Skriganov, and myself. So we proved it a few years ago. Konyagin is number theoretic person. Skriganov, I must say, is also closer to that.
Yes, that's wrong, but it's not pure analytic. It's not very useful mathematics. Well, the claim that they are good at discography.
I was going to say that, but I waited for a prompt from the audience, you see. So this is not exactly sharp. One can prove the upper bound with power 1. So just log. Double log of R. One can prove an upper bound for certain subsequences of R's. Right? But for all R's, this is this lower bound. So it is almost sharp. In this double logarithmic scale, it is not sharp in double logarithmic scale only. Okay. Now, what do we get from this? Why did I mention that? First thing, the first lesson we learned from here is that we know that this remainder estimate in the circle problem, when you study just the number of lattice point in the ball or in the circle in two dimensions, then the remainder is a wild function. We've seen the numerical simulation a few days ago. And you cannot say that this is bounded from below or from above. This oscillates very wildly. But if you take the maximal value in K in the center of the ball, so you move the center of the ball, then you get good lower bound, upper bounds and lower bounds. This is the first lesson. And the second lesson is that, now, corollary from this stuff, corollary 2, now we can estimate this delta variation. Assume that D is not 1 modulo 4, yes. So I don't want to deal with this case. I just want this regular 1 case. Then denote this delta naught to be lambda 3 minus D over 2, I think. I believe that this is correct. I will check that. Yeah. No, 3 minus d over 4. This is what I wanted to say. 3 minus d over 4. Okay. And then this quantity, the delta variation, will be bounded from below by constant lambda d minus 1 over 2. For all delta between 0 and delta naught. Right? So if you take this delta to be dependent on lambda, then you can write this estimate, which has this form. Sorry, this is not... I keep writing d minus 1 over 2 because this is the formula I'm after. But in fact, the result is this, d minus 1 over 4. Okay? So this is over 4. And this is true with delta depending on lambda. Notice that for two dimensions or three dimensions, this gives you a very nice result. Delta naught is growing in two dimensions. It is lambda one quarter. And this variation grows like lambda one quarter. And if you, in three dimensions, then delta is of order one, and the variation grows like 3 minus 1, this grows like 1/2. Okay? If you ask me whether they're precise or not, they're probably precise, because this is exactly the best possible remainder estimate in the circle problem for two dimensions, 1/4. Lambda 1/4 or r 1/2. So one should remember that lambda is r squared here. The best possible remainder was assumed to be, this is the hypothesis, this is the conjecture, 1/4 plus epsilon. And in three-dimensional case, the best possible is 1/2 plus epsilon. So these are pretty tight. All right, if you increase the dimension, then unfortunately all these nice features, they disappear. Yes? Because of that formula. Because if you have this funny exponential there, then you would have to change those estimates. I just didn't want to write it. Why does this enter? Because this is your function R plus.
Why is dimension 1/4 given
a different answer? There is a technical explanation to that. But a very simple one. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to spend time on this because I want to come quicker to other things. But there must be some very deep universal reason for that. Nobody knows this. I don't know. I mean, there must be some kind of additional symmetry in these cases. These are, you see, those cases are where the d minus one dimensional sphere has dimension 4. Dimension 4 pops up all over the place, everywhere, but in connection with different things. And probably this is one of those cases. I don't have any other explanation. I talk to number theorists, and they just say, good. That's all. They don't know. They don't. It's an interesting question. Yes. Okay. So all these things. If we increase the dimension, then we see that delta becomes lambda dependent, and the right hand side here becomes quite small, right? It is divided by 4. In here we have the term d minus 2 over 2, right? This is what we want to get, and this is why we are going to work now with rational lattices. Rational lattices will produce a bound of this type, and so here is the main result. Well, before I state this, I need to give the definition. This to be definition 3. Lattice gamma is rational if for any gamma 1, gamma 2 from the lattice, so you take a product, scalar product of every two lattice vectors. I will denote scalar product by the angular brackets. You have this, okay, where this beta r 1/2 with the index 1/2, where beta is a independent, a real number independent of gamma 1, gamma 2, and R12, of course, depends on these two vectors, and this is integer. Okay. This is integer vector. We will assume that beta equals 1. We can always do that by rescaling the lattice, right? And it will also change, of course, it will change those quantities, but in a controllable way, just rescaling. Okay, let's go on. Now the main result, main theorem. For dimensions starting from 4, the properties of counting function for the lattices will depend dramatically on the on these properties. Either it is rational or not. So we will assume that d is greater than 4. Then there exists a delta naught, lambda naught. These are positive numbers such that the variation is bounded by from below by this for all delta between 0 and this fixed delta naught and for all large lambda if the dimension is at least 5. Five-dimensional case is the borderline. And if you are in four dimensions, then you have this bound. You have double log again. For four-dimensional case. And one can say yet another thing. And if your lattice is Z4, so this is a cubic lattice, a special case of four-dimensional lattice, then this quantity is just bounded by lambda. Right? So it is, again, the same estimate as in five-dimensional, as a higher-dimensional case without any log, but only for this special case. For rational lattices. Thank you very much. Now, usual question, is this result sharp? The answer is yes, it is. We're going to see this in a second. Spectral implications are obvious, as I said in the beginning. This estimate implies that however far in the spectrum you go to infinity, each spectral band will contain an interval of fixed length. Which is not true for arbitrary lattices. So for rational lattices, it is true. Now, what is known? What is known about this? Now, for rational lattices, this is rational gamma, we have this. We know that n plus minus is, again, the usual term. I'm not writing it again out. This is just a universal constant times Rd plus O d minus 2. Okay? So this is O d minus 2. This is a result known since '24. This is for d starting from 5. Right? If dimension is 5 and higher, then you have this estimate. As you can see, this is the precise. These two estimates support each other, and they prove that the other estimate is precise. Okay, so this is for rational lattices. Now, if you want to deal with irrational lattices, then your error estimate is replaced by O small in here. And this is resolved by Goetze. 2000. And again for the same dimensions, starting from 5 and higher. Irrational. This is for irrational lattices. Irrational lattices, any lattice which is not rational. Yeah. And one can say even more. Actually, one can go further and say that there are examples of irrational lattices for which you have in this error. So these are examples that the error estimate is of order d over 2 plus epsilon. This is done again in the same dimensions by Yarnik in 28. Well, you see that quite a few of the results that I'm quoting are proved essentially a century ago. So these are old but not but still important and surprising results. So as I said, these are examples of irrational lattices, the whole class of irrational lattices, when you have this kind of order, d over 2. This is a huge difference. This is d, this is d over 2. So irrational lattices could be either very good or very bad. It depends on which way you look at this estimate. What is your point of view? Look, this d over 2, r d over 2, and lambda d over 4, these are the same powers here. Right? So this shows that this is probably the best possible for general lattices, for irrational lattices. And the estimate that is stated there is obviously best possible for, well, the sharp for rational lattices. This is the estimate. Okay? So this is the result. Okay. Now, how much time do I have? Say again?
15 minutes.
Thank you. It's the usual story. Time flies. It is obvious that I will not be able to tell you all the story about the proof, but at least I will be able to tell you the main idea of the proof. Main idea of the proof. Now, let's take a rational lattice. Let's look at the rational lattice. So we have it on the board. And then we look at the spheres that can centered at zero that contain lattice points. This is the structure. So we have a sphere which contains lattice points. Then we take the next one and the next one and so on. So we'll have the whole collection, infinite collection of the spheres. We are going to denote their radii by RS. We're going to label them like this. So we're in increasing order, RS, RS plus 1. Starting from R1. Between these spheres, there is nothing. There are no integer points. There is no lattice points. Multiplicity of what? No, I just counted once. RS is just one index for a sphere that contains integer points, lattice points, excuse me. Okay? Now, why do we look at rational lattices? Because we know that if you look at these spheres that, and if one sphere contains one point, you know that there will be a lot more. If you have a rational lattice, but this is not the case, you can have spheres containing very, very few points. But in the rational case, this number can be actually estimated from below. In the rational case. This is why we want rational lattices. Now, let's look now at what we want to prove. We want to prove that when we start moving the sphere around. Let's take a sphere, let's take this picture and magnify it. So this is one of those spheres. I will shade it. It will be convenient. Then I have another one, the next one. So this is RS. This is RS plus 1. There is nothing in between, and this is appropriate to call this empty shell. At the moment, it is k equals 0. So this is 0 here. Well, I will have to move it a bit later, but let's assume now that this is 0. Now, I will take a sphere of some arbitrary radius between these two, and as long as this sphere rattles between these two, the number of lattice points inside this sphere will be the same as inside this sphere, right? Even if I move it around, move the center from zero. I move the center, but the number of points stays the same. As soon as this sphere crosses the interior sphere or exterior sphere, the number of points changes. And this is the effect I'm chasing. I want this effect. Huh? Sorry?
It may change.
It will change. If I what?
If you cross it in a direction where there is no point.
The thing is that the points are uniformly distributed on the sphere. So this is the point. We're going to exploit this effect. In fact, you can take different points of view. If you want to use the minimal information available, you can say this. If you have points on the sphere, let's choose the direction in which you have the cluster of points and move the sphere in this direction, and then you will catch exactly this cluster. So the number of points will change if we cross the interior sphere or exterior. The question is, this sphere that we are moving around can cross both of them as well, and then the number of lost points and acquired points may compensate each other. So we need to see difference between two cases. Let me...
You will do not in the opposite direction, but in some direction.
In some directions, yes, that's right. In principle, as I said, the uniformity of distribution is known, so we can move in any direction. Okay? But we don't have to. Suppose that we don't know that we have uniformity of distribution. We can move in direction where you have the concentration of points. So let me indicate here by the dotted line just the halfway between these two spheres, exterior and interior one. Right? So this radius is going to be RS plus 1 over 2. If the radius, now it is all, and this is just elementary geometry, if the radius of this sphere is less than this mean value, then the first thing that will happen, that this sphere will cross the interior sphere when we move it. And we don't have to worry about the exterior one. So this is the effect we are going to catch. On the contrary, if this radius is larger than this mean value, then it will cross the exterior one. And what will happen? Let's look at this picture. Now we have one sphere, we have another sphere. Now, as I said, if this effect happens, so this is the interior sphere, then this sphere, the larger one, loses points. And how many points does it lose? It loses all the points that are in this domain. In particular, it loses the points that live on this part of the surface. Okay? And we're going to call this part of the surface, I'm not sure that I need to introduce this notion, we can call it this spherical cap, right? This is a natural name for it. Okay. And another thing, so we can now deal with each sphere, we can now say which of these two spheres, interior or exterior, will be crossed first, depending on the value of the radius with respect to this quantity. Okay. Now, in the statement of the main result, you see this parameter delta. This means that we cannot just be happy with one. We cannot just say this radius is under the mean value or over the mean value. We will have to ensure that we get uniform bounds for radii in the fixed interval. Okay? So we need to choose the radii in the fixed interval, and then to make sure that they all simultaneously either lose points or acquire new points when the sphere is moving. But if your radii is in the interval which is just around this middle radius. So if the sphere that I'm talking about contains this mean value radius, then some of the spheres in this shell will acquire new points when they cross this exterior sphere, and some of them will lose points when they cross the interior sphere. I don't want this to happen. I want them to behave uniformly, either all losing or all acquiring new points. So I will have to do something else. And then, instead of zero, I will choose a different center. I will try to choose a different center. I will move this point into a different point so that these spheres that contain lattice points are now at different places. And I will ensure that this will never happen by choosing appropriate position of the center. Okay, so this is a subtle point, but very important one for the proof. And this will, so I will have two sets of centers, right? So this is, zero gives you one set of centers, and then I will have another set of centers, which comes from the necessity of moving the spheres around. So I will have one set of centers, Ks. I will label it 1. And then I will have another set of centers, K2. And I will also have different radii, RS1 and RS2. Okay. Now, this spectral analogy or spectral interpretation is useful because I don't have to explain why I sometimes look at R squared. When I square radii, I'm talking about the energy. So associated with these two radii, with these two sets of radii, I will have to introduce two sets of intervals. The first set of intervals is associated with these two, with this spheres that I introduced in the beginning. Right? The left hand of the interval will correspond to the energy which is given by the radius of the interior sphere. So this will be the interval S1, and this is the with minus sign, meaning that this is the interval coming from inside. And this is RS1 squared. Then in here I put the mean value squared, RS squared R2, S squared over 2. Well, this is the mean value of the squares, but when you take large values of those, it is exactly, essentially the same as the square of the mean value. Then I will take the second interval, plus, meaning that this is the interval corresponding to these two radii, right? The interval that is written here corresponds to this radius and this radius. And the interval I'm going to write corresponds to this radius and that one. So this is this value. RS plus 1 squared. Sorry, this is 1, this is 1 squared. And this is 1. This is just the same set of radii corresponding to 1. And the same, I will do the same for the second set of radii. I will introduce those intervals, and they look like this. One can prove that they look like that. So these intervals definitely, they don't overlap, but they touch each other. These are the same points. So you have delta 1, 1, delta 1, 1 plus. Then you have delta 2, 1 minus delta 2, 1 plus, right? So these are intervals that cover semi-axis. They don't cover the axis because they start from a positive value, but they cover a semi-axis here in this direction. And then when I will choose the position of the centers for the second set of spheres in such a way that the intervals will overlap with those. There will be always a non-trivial overlap, something like this. So they will start like that. They will be shorter, but they will be always overlap. So you can visualize this kind of picture. So never the endpoints coincide. Never. The endpoints will be always at different spots. And there will be always separation between endpoints. Okay, so the overlap will be positive all the time. And when the overlap is positive, we can always, we can take this energy interval corresponding to these spheres around, corresponding to this delta. Where is that? Corresponding to this delta. And we'll be always able to take this interval and put it where the intervals overlap. So, for example, if, so this is delta minus delta plus, if our interval corresponding to the lambda falls right on this end point of these two intervals, then instead of this sequence of radii, we will take the second sequence of radii where this interval falls in the middle of the interval. And this is what we will do. How much time I have left? 4 minutes. Good. Okay, now this is the main idea of the proof. So you move the spheres, either you lose points or you acquire points, and the point is that the main technical reason why it works is that we can always estimate the number of lattice points on the spheres. When you estimate number of lattice points on the spheres, this means that you study representation of integers by integer quadratic forms. If you have a square lattice, all the points on the spheres, you square them, right? And you study representation of integers by the sum of squares, right? So for cubic lattices, this is a very standard, or not standard, classical problem. When you have quadratic forms, this is much worse, because you have to write a very long formula, and you will have to really to find out when an integer can be represented by a quadratic form. I have this planned to explain to you how this representation works. Let me just tell you how it works for cubic lattices. This is the simplest case. Cubic lattice. So gamma is nothing but Zd, and d starts with 4. Now, if we want to find the number of integers, it's natural to call them integers now, number of integers on the spheres, let me take sphere centered at 0 now. It doesn't really matter now. Then what will happen with that? Of course, you cannot say that every... You can say that if you square every natural number is representable as the sum of at least 4 squares. So for every m in the class of natural numbers, you have the following representation. You have xj squared, and j runs from 1 to d. You always have that. This means that all the spheres whose radii are given as roots of naturals are the spheres where you have lattice points. Now the question is how many of those you have. So here we have r square root of m. How many of those do we have here? For the five-dimensional case and higher, there is a very nice bound. This is m. This is r d minus 2 if you start from dimension 5. This is a well-known bound. And there is actually an upper bound as well, the same order. But I'm interested in lower bounds not only. But And this is why we have a difference. We have such a nice result in five-dimensional case. For the number of representations by quadratic forms, the bound is the same. It is more difficult to get. This is not such a classical problem. But the result is the same, and this is why we have this nice formula for the five-dimensional case and higher. For four dimensions, situation is bad. There exists a formula, a classical one, that if you want to represent number m as a sum of squares, that then the number of representations has the following form. You sum over all divisors of number m, all of them, not only prime divisors. You sum all of them, but avoid divisors that are 0 modulo 4. Okay. This is the theorem number 386 in Hardy and Wright book. Surprisingly, they number theorems from 1, and the number just increases. They don't have this section and chapter numbers. They just increase in numeration. So this is the formula for the four-dimensional case. And if you look at it carefully, for example, if you take this number to be power of 2, then you will see that there will be a huge drop in the number of representations. Number 1024 and number 16, they have exactly the same number of representations by squares, okay, which is 24, all right? So four-dimensional case is dangerous, but we still have this estimate here. We still have this estimate for the cubic lattice because we avoid this kind of numbers that are powers of 2. Because we choose the position of the center, I told you that by choosing the position of the center, we can vary the number. We choose the position of the center in such a way that we reduce it to the problem of counting number of representations for numbers that do not have this kind of divisors. Okay? For example, we count number of representations for numbers of this type. S is a natural number. And of course, the 4 is not a divisor of this. This is not a power of 2. Okay. Well, unfortunately, I didn't have time to talk about quadratic forms and to give more details of the proof. But I mean, this is the last talk, and I don't want to be too technical. Thank you very much. Forgotten, okay.
Yes.
Convex domain. Well, I guess that. Did you have a paper on that? This is for plane. Any dimension. Just the point where the convexity breaks down, isn't it?
Strong
convex. Yes.
Inflection.
All right. The cusp is a bit too dramatic, isn't it? Yeah. So it was not even convex.
Well, the question has been for today.